Jasmine.
Hi, Jasmine. Jasmine, come on, yeah.
Hi, Hannah. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How about yourself?
Okay. Thank
okay.
you.
Is
you have
it
a question
cold
for tonight?
I'm sorry,
cold
go ahead.
Here?
Yeah,
no.
We had a little cold spell, so.
Really?
Yeah,
oh, it was getting a little chilly at night, but that's about it.
Well, it was about 42 degrees all day.
Oh, there?
You
wow.
know, that's cold when we're so used to
it
80.
Is. Well, we were today 77, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. But it was a beautiful day.
Mm-hmm. Marco. No, no, so he hasn't come on yet.
Okay.
Is it cold in Lake Charles?
Yeah, all day it was 42. Plus it
yeah.
rained, so that made it kind of dampy cold.
Right. I think it's supposed to be cold all week, or through the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Jasmine, I know about your question. Does anybody else have any questions?
Well, I'd like to bring up something that you and Jasmine were discussing last Wednesday. I missed the question and answer, but I was able to listen to the recording. And having to do with the syllable ha that you talked about. I don't know if you remember it, with the chet and the patak under it. I think maybe, did you say something about you never have been able to find anything as for why? That's the only time in the in Hebrew that we pronounce the vowel before we pronounce the consonant. Do you remember that from last
right.
week?
Yes. I had never heard anybody explain why that was true.
Okay. Well, I hadn't either, but I didn't really focus on it so much in that realm. I often wondered why the Nazarites felt we needed to have two vowel, I call them vowel markers, diacritical marks, whatever you want, you know, call them, for the same sound, because the kamatz makes the ah sound, and so does the patak. And so with your question and my puzzling question as well, the only thing I've asked rabbis who, through the years about why why two vowel markers with the same sound, I got told, well, one had a stronger emphasis, stronger sound than the other, the Klamath being stronger than the Patak. But when you're reading or you're speaking, you don't really hear the difference. So that never actually satisfied me. And then I think when you and Jasmine made those comments, it brought all that back to my memory again. And I got to what came to me after contemplating this was that you've taught us that Kuf is a double agent, and of course Kuf or Kof, however you want to pronounce it, lends itself to both sides. And in my classroom with the Hebrew alphabet at the top of the chalkboard, it's real noticeable that Kuf is the only letter actually facing the Aleph. So there was even the visual picture that it was a double agent. So bringing back to mind that Hashem is just like he had a prophet for the Jewish people in Moses, he also had a prophet for the nations in the form of Balaam. So I made the connection that, well, if there was a consonant that was a double agent, then perhaps there was a vowel marker or sound that also was a double agent. And then I think a few days later when we were doing the Zohar reading, one of the verses commented that Chokhma and Chesed, they linked, and you made the comment, even though Chokhma we normally think of as right column, and so does Chesed, that they were sort of linked to the two not being right column. So I looked at the Tikkun HaNefesh chart, and sure enough, Chokhma had the vowel of the Patak. So I guess after all of that, my question is, could it be that syllable, where we pronounce the ah before the and it's in the word Noach, which we've been studying for quite a while in the Zohar, that vowel, Patak, is a double agent.
I just want to clarify, because I always get them mixed up. The Patak is the T or the straight line?
Yeah, it's the T. The way I remember it is the word Kamatz has a T in it. And so I associate the little bitty T with Kamatz. And the Patak is a straight line. So if you say, oh, a plain straight line. I was never taught the names of the vowels in any of the classes I took when the rabbis would take, so I had to teach myself the vowels and the vowel names, I should say. And so I, you know, tried to use little clues to help me remember them.
Understood. So my answer to you about the double agent being the Patak, the answer has to be no. Because the Patak is the vowel that the Zohar says is connected to Keter.
Okay.
And the double agent would not be in Keter.
Okay.
That's one. A second aspect about the Patak, while we see it as a little T, because that's the way they print it, but it actually is a line with a dot underneath it touching the line. And so when we add gematriot, number value, for vowels, which we sometimes do,
It's 16.
The Tati is 16, while the Tamats is 16, and the Patakas is 6. But 16 is the gematria of the male letters in the name of Hashem. And the Patach, which would be translated as open, is a female vowel. And the female vowel is more connected. So if it was going to be one of those two that was a double agent, and I have never heard that, and I appreciate that it is something that you've thought of, and it if it's true, it's a tremendous chiddush, a tremendous new Torah teaching. But if it was one of those two letters, or took one of those two vowels, it would be the female vowel, because the female is more open. The female is more connected to the negative system. Because why? Because the negative system is about receiving. It's a left column, which is what, and so the Patach is that way.
And that's the vowel it's consonant. You know, that we say
right.
Ak, unless it's at the beginning of a word or in medial position, then it would be Ha. But
well,
since
correct.
That's, you know, the only tone, I just felt like, well, there's got to be a reason.
There is a reason, and as you were saying, the reason occurred to me, so I was going to mention it, but again, this is just something that occurred to me. It doesn't mean that it's correct. I haven't heard it from a teacher, so take it with that understanding. But the letter Chet has a very strong connection to the upper worlds, because it is formed from a Vav and a Zion, and the two strokes that make up the little carrot or the little house on top. So if we look at the gematria of those, the Vav and the Zion is 13, 6 plus 7. And the two strokes of the carrot, or the two strokes of the house on top, connects it to the number 15, which is what we were talking about earlier today, the word Yah, Yud-Heh, which is the upper world. So the Chet is very connected to the energy of the upper worlds. It's also connected to the lower world in the context of sin. The word chet is cognate to the letter chet. Chet is Hebrew for sin. It's spelled chet, tet, aleph. It has a gematria of 18. Same gematria as the word for chai, life. So you see the duality that's built into the chet. It's got a Vav, which is Zeron Pin, and a Zion, which is Malchut. So you see unity, and you see connection to the upper world. What you're really describing is a tremendous amount of energy. Now, the vowel under it is the Patach, the openness, meaning it's a feminine, meaning that it's easily drawn from. So if we were to say Ha, there is no limitation from the sound standpoint of all of that energy flow going to the negative system. But when we say Ach, the vowel first, we're creating a barrier to that energy flow. That's what occurred to me as you were talking, Chana.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you. The letters continue to fascinate me, so I don't know if anything that has to do with that.
Well, as you know, they do me as well. So, besides Jasmine, who I know wants to ask a question, are there any other questions from anybody else?
I have one.
Go ahead.
We talked about individuals buried in Israel, and we had a study a couple of nights ago about they will be shaken, their garments are shaken out. So all the individuals that are buried outside of Israel that were part of Jacob's children, which were most of them are buried in Egypt. Joseph is not, of course, and Jacob is not, and a couple others aren't. So all those that have died in the land in Egypt are not buried in Israel. And then there's some individuals in Israel that are buried that are not part of the children of Jacob and or Israelites, I assume. So, and we touched on that, and will they be, how is that process going to take place when the Messiah, when the Mashiach comes, and the righteous are opening up the graves for the resurrection of the dead. I'm not quite sure on that process. But and again, let's say a group of us went to Israel, and God forbid something happened to us, and of course they would send us back to our homeland. So let's just say that we couldn't get back in time for a decent burial. And we are in Israel and they bury us there, which I don't think that's going to happen, but just that scenario, what would happen to our body?
It does happen. Sometimes the people do die when they go on a tour to Israel, and they are buried in Israel. But finish your question.
That was my question. What happens if we're not righteous, or we're not in that first resurrection? Because it says that the children of Israel will be resurrected first. And it also,
correct,
I believe it says that the females will be resurrected first.
What about
okay,
Moses? Not in the land. He wasn't buried in the land either.
Who?
Moses.
Moses. That's,
Moses.
Well, yes.
Moses was
and no.
buried outside of Israel, but he actually wasn't buried. It says he was buried in the Torah, but the Talmud says otherwise. But let's not confuse the issue here, because it's
okay.
Confusing enough as it is.
All right.
So what you're really asking, I believe, and I want to clarify, is you want to know what is the process of the resurrection of the dead and the order of the resurrection of the dead as it is done, correct? Is that a correct question?
Yes, that is the question.
Okay. So what the sages have taught us is, and what the Ari has said, and this book that we are reading is saying, is that the first bodies to be reunited with their souls and resurrected will be the children of Israel who have died and been buried in the land of Israel. Next will be the children of Israel who were buried outside of Israel in the exile. Next would be the other nations who died in Israel. And the last would be the other nations outside of Israel. Now, did that answer your question, or do you need some further clarification? And if so,
yeah,
you need to clarify what you're looking for.
Okay. What if I say, okay, if I pass away here in my state of Louisiana, but this is not where I want to be buried. I want to be buried in Israel. Let's just say that. And I know that,
okay,
you know, the burial sites are very limited, and as far as being buried in Israel. So who said what?
Who said that the burial sites are very limited?
Well, I mean, in Jerusalem, and
again, who said there's enough burial sites?
Okay.
If you want to be buried in Israel, and you arrange to have your body transported to Israel and buried there, which is in a very expensive process, that mm-hmm. takes place all the time. But what the book that we were reading that you're referring to is the goodness of the land of Israel. It says that the people who die outside of Israel, they die outside for a reason, and they may not have the merit to be transported to Israel, and so they're an affront to the land, and so they are dealt with. You know, they're buried in Israel because I hate to say it, but there are people who will do many things for money without understanding the spiritual effect. But Hashem guards the land. The land guards itself. So if someone wants to be buried in Israel and makes that happen on the physical level, it means that it's appropriate for them to be buried in Israel on the spiritual level. So they will be a child of Israel that's resurrected, or they'll be one of the other nations who died in Israel who are resurrected in the third step. But there's no shortage of burial sites anywhere in the world. It's just a question of what is the scarcity of the land that is created by the mortuary industry and so forth.
Yeah, I guess I was, that statement that there was no, or burial sites was scarce, especially on the Temple Mount, that's probably where my area of saying there was, you know, very scarce burial sites at the Temple Mount.
To be buried on the Temple Mount, I'm not familiar enough to know what the actual procedure is. I doubt if there are people from outside of Israel who are allowed to be buried on the buried,
right,
the Temple Mount.
Right. Okay.
And especially in the current political environments where the Temple Mount is guarded by the Israeli government, but is controlled by the Muslim religious government. Which does lead us to Jasmine's question, unless you have some more, Martha.
No, Jasmine's question. I do have another, but I can wait for that. That's just something that happened today on a political scale. I just wanted to ask, but mine can wait.
Why don't you verbalize it? Because that's what she's asking.
Oh, about the embassy being moved to Jerusalem and that being stated that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. That's what I heard today. Okay. And that was I just want to hear your viewpoints about that from a Zohar standpoint.
Jasmine, was there anything else in addition to that you wanted to ask?
No, that's it.
So you both want to know, and others, I'm sure, want to know my viewpoints for whatever reason as to the meaning behind why the embassy was moved. So you all are aware that the U.S. government has identified that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, the modern state of Israel, since 1967. But there's a differentiation between two parts of Jerusalem. One is called the West Jerusalem and the other is East Jerusalem. The Temple Mount is in East Jerusalem. Many of the kevers, the graves of the Tzaddikim, are in East Jerusalem, Rachel being one, Joseph being another, and many others, of course. So the Israeli government since 1967 has been in West Jerusalem. And the 86, notice the number, 86 countries have their embassies in Tel Aviv, but they drive to Jerusalem every day. They have consulates in Jerusalem so that they can meet with the Israeli government. Because the Israeli government is not in Tel Aviv, it's in Jerusalem. So what the American President Trump did today was go through a photo op. On the one hand, he said, a photo opportunity. If you watched any of the news stations, they showed you this beautiful paper with his very large signature saying that he was ordering the embassy to be moved to Jerusalem. Except the paper that he signed was a 6-month extension, which the presidents of the United States have been doing since 1995, I believe, for 22 years. Because the bipartisan Congress in those years, and every year, all the years since, has supported the modern state of Israel because it is a democracy, because it's a friend of the United States, because it's out of its own self-preservation, has tremendous amount of on-site spies in the Arab countries that keeps the American CIA and all of the national security forms, keeps them supplied with information that they cannot get otherwise. And so for these 22 years, the American government has said Israel has said the capital is Jerusalem, West Jerusalem specifically, and we agree, except we don't have our embassy there. Because if we had our embassy there, we are forcing a condition on the city of Jerusalem that we, the 86 countries, maintain should be done and dealt with in face-to-face negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians. So what happened today was a photo opportunity. Our current president of the United States has made his core group of voters happy because he promised to do this, and now he's done it. But he hasn't done anything. He hasn't changed anything. He is still extended for another 6 months. If he really was going to do it, he has a building in West Jerusalem, two of them, called consulates. All he had to do was put a new sign on them that said embassy. And then over time, he can move the apparatus of the embassy. But if he really wanted to do it, it could have happened overnight. But why didn't it happen overnight is because our current president is a very tactical person, not a strategic planner, but a tactical approach. And he is having trouble getting the Palestinians to sit down with the Israelis. So he has now said to the Palestinians, and this is something that I think is true, but I can't prove it to you, and it will only come out in history to see if it's true. He had a conversation, a telephone conversation, with Abbas, the Palestinian leader, 2 days ago, where he told him, I'm going to do this. But what else was said in that call is not explained. And in my opinion, what he said was, you don't want to sit down with the Israelis face to face, that's fine. Then I'm going to move the embassy, and I'm also going to give Israel approval of taking over the Temple Mount and taking over the West Bank, which they control militarily anyway. So I'm not going to fight them. I'm going to tell them, go ahead and do it permanently. But if you want to sit down with them, I'll hold off. So I'm going to sign that they're moving the embassy, but I'm going to give it another 6 month extension. And this is all manipulation that is behind the scenes of how he works, not in America, which is a very difficult place to be political. Why? Because of the free press. Everything is observed, everything is known, everything is leaked, everything becomes known quickly. So how can we manipulate? How can we negotiate? You can't negotiate in public, because you negotiate in public, everybody gets upset on all the sides because they think you're doing something wrong. There's no ability to be tactical. There's no ability to be to implement strategies when there's public. At least that's his worldview. Whether that's true or not, it's a totally separate question. So you're asking my opinion of what took place today? Nothing. it's an opportunity for the Palestinians to create chaos. It's an opportunity for people to be upset. It's an opportunity for people to express their fears. But in practical matter, the embassy is not moved, and in my opinion will not be moved, because I think the Palestinians will sit down with the Israelis and they will attempt to get to a peace treaty. And there are wrongs on both sides and there are rights on both sides. And we are not exposed to those wrongs and we are not exposed to the rights on some one side or the other, because the media that we follow is a one-sided media. It's not a pure one. But the other side as well uses their propaganda. And if you go back in history just a little bit before 1967 to 1947, the Arab countries created the Palestinians. They created the refugee camps because they wouldn't allow these people into their countries as citizens or even as immigrants. They were forced to live in camps. And who paid for the camps? The United Nations. And who taught the people in the camps? The United Nations. And what was the passport that the people in the camps received? They received UN passports. And they went to college in various countries on scholarships. And who is the middle management of the United Nations today? This is it's an estimate on my part, but it's probably 80% Palestinian, 80% educated in the camps, in the refugee camps. And that's why you have so much animosity towards Israel in the General Assembly, while you get all the support in the Security Council. But this is the world that we live in, and we're not really aware of all of these ins and outs. And what I've said to you is not necessarily true. It's my perception, my intuition, my understanding of the world, which is, maybe it's corrupted, who knows? But it is what I feel is correct. And I don't know why you asked my opinion, because you can make up your own opinion. And the real question is, you'll be hearing how wonderful this is from the Israeli side and how horrible this is from the Palestinian side. And the truth is in the middle. Do either side truly want peace? Or do they like the status quo? There are those who want this to be a point on the line of Mashiach. We're in the end of days. Mashiach is around the corner. So this is just another sign that you should all move to Israel. And you'll hear that out of the Orthodox rabbis. And getting back to even the discussion that we just had about being buried in the land of Israel, Where is the land of Israel? You think it's in the Middle East, or is it in your consciousness? Remember, every time I lay tefillin, I have to go to the land of Israel. I have to consciously think of going there, of being on the Temple Mount, or being in the cave of Machpelah, or being in Tzfat. I have to run and think about that before I lay the tefillin, or I'm not laying it properly. So where is the land of Israel? It's in my head. But I want Mashiach now. You've all heard the statement, and it's not just the Chabad group that says it. Many of the Orthodox groups are saying it. Many of the Reform groups are saying it. What do they mean, I want Mashiach now? I want that sense of peace and serenity that I'm promised. What are you going to do to earn it? Before the Mashiach can come, we have to have Armageddon, according to the prophecies, not necessarily the Armageddon war, but the Armageddon concept, the energy of Armageddon. What is that energy? It's world war, worldwide conflict. Part of that worldwide conflict was a conflict between communism as practiced in Russia and capitalism as practiced in many places, and the socialism being the intermediary practiced in many places also. Do you really want Mashiach now? Do you want the Armageddon war? Do you want to have the conflict? Are you ready to sell your home and move to Israel? Are you ready to have your home not sold, but you be told to leave and go to Israel, the land of Israel in the Middle East, where it's not all that comfortable? In the sense, it's not a middle-class lifestyle. The highest levels, the highest class is not a middle class in America. Are you ready to leave this comfort zone? Why is Americans' middle class being destroyed? Oh, it's being destroyed? Yeah, it's being destroyed. It's shrinking. People who were once middle class are now poor. A few have made it to the billionaire status. Do you want Mashiach? Are you willing to make the changes that you need to make so that Mashiach comes without an Armageddon war, but it comes with a process? A process of diplomacy? A process of peace being exchanged, treaties being signed. How much are you willing to change yourself? So don't ask the question, what is the meaning of moving the embassy to Israel? Excuse me, to Jerusalem. Ask yourself, how much am I willing to change myself in order to bring serenity into the world, to bring peace into the world? Am I willing to bring the homeless into my extra bedroom? Am I willing to feed the homeless every day? Am I willing to not save but use those funds today to help people who are less fortunate than I? What was the gift of Bernie Madoff? You found out that Hadassah had $500 million investing for a rainy day. How many poor people could they have helped? How many people could they have educated? And the same is true of all of the other Jewish charities that invested with Madoff. Nobody told you that the $100 you gave every year to the Hadassah and Ort and all of the various Jewish charities, nobody told you that 80 cents of that was being put away for a rainy day. But how soon we forget, how much we don't realize and we don't really think through. So my opinion of today's events of the U.S. Embassy being moved to Israel, to Jerusalem, is strictly a photo opportunity for the image making for the current president of the United States. Now, are there other questions or somebody else would like to express their opinion, please feel free.
Well, I just have to say that I learned a lot with what all you say, because I didn't have a clue of what, you know, the document and all the things I have you have said. So now I'm more clear about it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
My question is a follow-up on that. What if, and what if it is moved in 6 months to Israel? What if it really does happen?
It's already happened. Israel was the victor in 1967. Israel had its capital in Tel Aviv in 1966. From 1947 to 1966, they were building their infrastructure in West Jerusalem. So they declared Jerusalem was their capital. And the government of Israel has been in Jerusalem at least since 1967, if not before. So there's no change. Whether America moves its embassy or not, the government of Israel takes place in Jerusalem.
Wow.
And what gets negotiated between the Palestinians and the Israelis, there can be both governments in the city of Jerusalem if they truly want that to happen and want peace. And if it doesn't happen, the movement of the embassy to Jerusalem doesn't change anything. It just manifests what the American Congress said in 1995. Am I being clear with that, or is that confusing?
So basically, you're talking about the government. They're both in Jerusalem. The Palestinians and the Israel government is in Jerusalem. This is a physical location. What?
But right now, that is not a true statement. Only the Israeli government is in Jerusalem.
Okay.
The Palestinian government is outside of Jerusalem in one of the other cities in the West Bank.
Okay.
Palestinians want their government to be, the capital to be in Jerusalem.
They claim it as their capital. They want it to be their capital.
They do want it to be their capital.
Not Israel's and Palestinians in the land of Jerusalem. They want it for themselves, basically.
There are people who say that is their goal. That they want one state, not two states. That they want one state so that if it's a democratic one state, that the Jewish state will no longer exist because they're not, the population, I forget the word, but the demographics of the population, there are more non-Jews than Jews in the, if you have one state which includes the West Bank and the land of the modern state of Israel. So the two-state solution was what the United Nations set up in 1947. But the Arabs at that point
turned it down. Well, the Arabs turned that down.
And they then, they defeated, or they fought to a standstill in 1947. And so the Israelis had a country and developed an army, developed a country, and defended themselves a number of times. And the Arabs never let the Palestinians be a government. They always were in the camps under the supervision of the United Nations. And it's only probably around 1995 that the Palestinians came out of it with Yasser Arafat and his attempted revolution. But if by then you had all of these middle management bureaucrats having moved up in the United Nations bureaucracy.
Well, I know when Clinton was president, he pretty much would say whatever the Palestinians wanted for peace, he was trying to get peace. He was willing to give them anything they wanted at that point, and the Palestinians rejected that.
Martha, there's rejected what you say, but it's also false.
Okay.
If you go into the, you have to remember what peace was created. Well, peace was created was the Sinai give back with Egypt and Israel.
Right.
That's the only peace was ever created. The ceasefire in Gaza was Ariel Sharon, who was a general in the wars, then became prime minister, and he said, "I want peace. Let's try and give them back this land called Gaza that we have developed. We've put people in there, and they've developed. They have businesses. They have farms. We're going to give them back this land on the hopes that they want peace." And what took place was Hamas was put in control of Gaza by the election of the Palestinians. They didn't vote for Abbas and Yasser Arafat. They voted for Hamas. Now, whether that was under duress, because the Hamas was carrying the guns around town, I'm not that familiar with it. But what you've described just now, yes, there's truth in that. They rejected it. But did they reject it out of duress? Did they reject it out of, it wasn't really meant or given with good grace? It's not clear. I mean, the Orthodox world will tell you that Ariel Sharon got his due process by being in a coma for 7 years.
Right.
Is that real? Is that God's plan? You know, the Chabad Rebbe quoted, said all the time, never give back the land. The land of the modern state of Israel isn't real. The state of Israel is going to come from God, and it's going to go from the Mediterranean to the Euphrates River.
Right.
So don't give anything back. Trust in God and let the wars happen. I'm not saying that that's a good idea. I'm saying that if you really want to understand this, you have to understand it both biblically, from the Quran's point of view, from all of the different participants' point of view, and then you can come to a conclusion of what's right, what's wrong, but ultimately, it's all God's plan.
Right, and that's how I'm at. God's plan. We just have to watch it unfold in His own time.
And it will happen in its own time. If we were ready, it would already have happened. If it hasn't happened, it means we're not ready. So we have more work to do. But maybe we're supposed to bring the consciousness of Israel throughout the world. That was really the premise behind the Chabad Rebbe, who said, don't ever take communities out of the countries where they are and bring them to the land of Israel. It's not time yet. We need to pick up the sparks in those countries. We need to have people there. We need to have children of Israel who are revealed children of Israel. We have to have them so they can bring up the sparks.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't use that language, but that's what he was saying. He was asked very quite often, why didn't he go to the land of Israel? Why didn't he come visit? And his answer was, if I go into the land of Israel, I can't come out. And if I can't come out, there's nobody out there for those souls that are left out. So we have to wait till the world is ready. Now, there are opinions that say as soon as the worldwide Jewish population is more than half in the land of Israel, as soon as that takes place, the laws of all of those mitzvot having to do with the land will come into effect. So you think the conflict between Hamas and Arafat, the PLO, is unfathomable? Wait until you see that conflict, where the Orthodox says you've got to keep the Shemitah and you've got to do the Yovel.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to let the land lie fallow. And all of these other laws and mitzvot that we do in the land of Israel that we can't do with the temple's not there. The rabbis, the Orthodox rabbis, are saying, no, we don't need the temple built. We need half of the population.
What is that number? What is the population, half the population? What is that number?
It's an estimate. Nobody knows the worldwide Jewish population. Because how do you count all the people who have a Jewish mother but have practiced another religion? Do you depend on the way when you do a census, do you depend on what the person tells you? I was Jewish, now I'm not, God forbid. Or, you know, it depends on what you're doing. But essentially, there's supposedly about 13 million Jewish people around the world. Six million are in America. 5 million are in Israel. 500,000 are in England. 250,000 in Australia. And the rest are spread throughout the world. And that's about 3 years ago that I heard those numbers. And that's why they set up that organization, that the only way you can go from America to Israel is through that organization, whatever its name is.
Nefesh B'Nefesh.
Nefesh B'Nefesh, thank you. That's why they set it up, so that they can try and get more American Jews going into Israel to bring their money, to retire there, to come with their children, and have them strengthen get past the 50% level. Of course, they didn't tell you that, but they didn't say that. The Israeli government created the Nefesh B'Nefesh organization.
Nefesh
but it's run B'Nefesh. Out of the
Israeli
government. Now, always remember, these opinions I'm giving you are not necessarily true. They're what I have observed and what I have studied, what I have heard from many different sources. One of the strengths that I have, at least I think it's a strength, is that I listen to many different rabbis. I listen to many different organizations. I listen to many different news organizations. So I hear different approaches to the same subject. When you ask me an open question like you did tonight, you get this.
Okay. Oh, yay. Okay, can I change the subject?
Thing? Yes, you can.
Okay. My unborn grandson, they named him, and his name's going to be Caleb Joseph. What does that mean on a biblical scale?
It's a difficult question for me to answer you because I'm not sure what you want to hear. Do you really want to hear the truth?
Yes, I always want the truth.
Why are they giving them two names?
That's what American people do. I have two names. Most American people have two names.
That just means that most American people are schizophrenic. They have two souls within themselves.
Wow, I have two names.
Jasmine, you have more than two names.
Oh my goodness. Now you got me confused.
This may be another Wednesday night question. We may have to wait until next Wednesday to answer these questions.
That's okay, Jasmine. I have more than two names.
But I found that they all come back together as one.
Yes, they do. That is true in your case, Hannah. Let me tell you the story. This is a story about the early 1800s, and I don't remember which Hasidic sage it was involved with. But they came to him because the wife of the son was pregnant, and she wanted to know what she should name the baby, and they would only go to the Rebbe because he's the one most connected to Hashem. So he told them to name the baby after his father. I don't remember his name. Let's say it's Menachem. They went to the Rebbe, which was the lineage of the father of the child. But the mother had her family. She had her family line, and she wanted to honor them. So when the baby was born, they didn't name him Menachem. They named him Menachem Mendel. Something from one part of the family, something from the other part of the family. The other problem was...
A different story about that.
But similar, I'm sure. The only problem was, as the child grew, they saw that he wasn't as righteous as the grandfather he was named after. So they went back to the Rebbe and they said, "How come?" And he said, "Because you named him too. There's two people in that body." So sometimes he's the other. He didn't use the word schizophrenic, but that's what it is.
Well, we're all schizophrenic, man.
When you have two names, each of those names is related to who that person is, related to the correction of that person. Remember, your name represents your tikkun, represents your purpose of life, why you were brought into the world. It's a metaphor for your soul. And your soul is a metaphor for who you are, because you're not your body, you're your soul. So why do people have two names? Because there's two souls there. The way the sages and the Talmud describe the study of the names, in my own case, I was given one name, my Hebrew name. I was given an English name. Which name did I use? For most of the early part of my life, I used my English name. Because I was secular, I wasn't connected. But once I became connected and I understood the power of a name, I started to use my name. So let's use mine as an example. The way you study, and on my website somewhere, there's an essay by Rabbi Abraham Sutton where he describes what are the names of the child. So in my case, it's my name, Hanoch. Ben, being the son of Jacob and Chava. Those are my parents. And then I am the son of the next generation, my father's mother and father, and my mother's mother and father. So you have a total of seven names. And each of those names bring aspects of your tikkun. But all the time I've ever had to deal with this until we can automate it has been just to take the first name. And so when people come to me, as many people do, my name is X and Y. Or sometimes X, Y, and Z. You know, I only do one name because that's all the time I had to do, you know, time I can put for it. And I've already got 3,000 names that I haven't had time to do. Literally, I have a list of 3,000 names. That's why I have to live at least 300 more years to get this all accomplished. Everybody's quiet. Anybody got any questions? Hana, did you want to say something about the story you heard?
I think what I heard, it was similar. It was a couple came to the rabbi, and they had somewhat of a problem because they didn't know what to name their baby. But they both wanted Nachum. But it turned out that one on one side was a thief and the other was a righteous person. And the rabbi, and so they wondered what to do. And he said, well, if that's what you choose, then whenever he grows up, you'll find out if he had the soul of the thief or the righteous one. So it was similar.
Very, very, very nice.
I liked yours better.
But just, Malka, I do want to mention one thing. No matter what they're talking about naming the child now, at the moment of the Brit, they will receive the information of what to name the child. And they may name it one name, they may name it five names, because that's what the soul is. And they can talk about all the different names that they want. But the name that they finally settle on will be done at the moment of the Brit, because that's when they're given Ruach HaKodesh to know what it is. So, if somebody comes to me, what should I name my baby? We go through various analyses, but my final discussion with them is what you name will be determined by the soul. So don't put anything in cement in your mind. Call the baby what is the right name to call them at that moment.
Okay.
My father almost never called me Henry. He always referred to me as Gus. When he passed away, I was 16 years old. And I said to my mother, why did he call me Gus? And she said, I don't know. And then about 2 weeks later, she came to me and said, you know, that's what we used to call you when you were in utero. It was a nickname we had referring to you. And that's what my father always called me, because to him, that's who I was. No one else ever called me Gus. I never used Gus. I never understood why. But I always answered him because he was never calling me late to dinner.
It was,
I hope you enjoyed that.
Best friend in another life.
Probably. We all have stories about our names. We all have stories about our family history. We all have stories about who we are. And all of those stories have meaning to each one of us. But ultimately, it's a function of, it becomes, what are you doing today in your life to change your comfort zone? to get out of your comfort zone. That's what you're here to do. So what happens in Jerusalem will never stay in Jerusalem. But what happens in your life changes the world. What happens in Jerusalem doesn't change the world. Because what changes the world is what each of us do individually every day. You all have a beautiful evening. Tomorrow's classes at 4:30 will be a mini Zohar, and at 7 o'clock will be a Zohar for the Parsha of Vayeshev. Shalom to all.
Shalom.
Thank you.
Shalom.
Thanks.
Thank you.